You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF.
Good evening, and welcome to Inforum at the Commonwealth Club and tonight's conversation, Beyond Bro Culture, Tech's New Leadership Lens, in collaboration with the New York Times. I'm Pui Wing Tam, tech editor at the New York Times, and please join me in welcoming our panel, Josh Reeves, chief executive and co-founder of human resources company Gusto, Tina Sharkey, entrepreneur and advisor and co-founder of consumer product company Brandless, Wayne Sutton, the director of program development for Backstage Capital's Accelerator, and the founder of Change Catalyst and Tech Inclusion, and Bridget Fry, chief technology officer at tech-powered real estate company Redfin, and one of the few female executives in her role. There's lots to discuss about work culture, diversity, and inclusion tonight. So let's get started. First question for you panelists, and I'm hoping each of you will answer, is just to give us a state of play. Where are we in tech leadership right now, and where might things go from here? Josh, I'll start with you.
Yeah, happy to dive in. Pretty broad, open-ended topic, I would say. Maybe as a bit of backdrop, one of the few locals who was born here in Silicon Valley, so San Francisco, grew up in Marin, and so I'm going to frame it through my own experience, kind of seeing the up and down over the last 30, 40 years. I think as an industry, you know, tech is no longer a cottage industry. The biggest companies in the world are tech companies. I think as a region, Silicon Valley is now not just a place, it's more of a concept of disruption. And that's positive when it's applied to fixing problems, negative when we are setting an example in a way that we're not as proud of. I think on the topic of leadership itself, I think we're overdue for, you know, this type of conversation, frankly, not just in the last 10 years, but the last couple decades. I always talk about the cycle in the valley comes and goes. The core of it, I hope, stays pretty consistent. It's folks that just want to go fix problems and do it in a way they're proud of. I think as the cycle comes and goes, though, things get a lot more fluffy. And we've had a pretty bullish cycle for a while. And so we're overdue for some, I would say, heartfelt conversation on what's right and what's wrong.
Tina.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, if you look at the freshman class of Congress right now, you know, there had to be some dam breaking to actually get people out and motivated to get involved, get engaged, and run. And so I would say that you'll see a similar analogy. I mean, we just saw All Raise, which was the largest and first ever female venture capital gathering here in San Francisco on November 1st. 400 female venture capitalists came to San Francisco for the first time ever. And that organization has spawned not only the fusion of female venture capitalists as a community, but also, you know, Founders for Change and female founder office hours and mentorship. But you got to play the long game, right? Because you have to actually go all the way back to the earlier stage companies, to the girls in school, motivating them to make certain choices educationally, coach founders at the early stage, and then get cultures moving that can be informed by purpose-driven leadership that is not just for the entrepreneurship that is present in the Valley, but also the social entrepreneurship that can build for profit and for purpose. And so I think we're at that inflection point right now where there are many companies, Brandless included, that is unapologetically for profit, but deeply rooted in purpose from the day one. And so I think as you start to see those companies grow up and scale, the way they attract and retain talent, and as that talent goes out to the diaspora, hopefully they'll be kind of extending that those morals and the sort of the moral compass of what it means to scale a company where I think historically in Silicon Valley, scaling meant scale at any cost, you know, crawl through cut glass, you know, crush and burn. And that's just not tolerated anymore. And leadership needs to build cultures of inclusion to support that.
That's a great segue to Wayne, because you must see a lot of this with companies in the accelerator.
Yes. We're launching the accelerator in 2019. And so we're excited about seeing what type of companies we get and helping them create new cultures to impact the tech industry. In terms of what I've been seeing in terms of around leadership and diversity and inclusion, though, I come from different lands where I believe that we're in a sense of denial in terms of this whole tech industry around the problem of diversity and inclusion in tech. I think leaders are in denial in terms of why it's important. I think a lot of tech leaders have been getting by with releasing diversity numbers at their companies and organizations, hiring global head of diversity and inclusion officers. And while all those things are important and impactful and the right thing to do, there's not enough. And then also there's another layer with that. So you have a leadership layer. And I think when you look at the layer of the unrepresented people in tech, I think there's a layer of frustration. A frustration of why things hadn't changed, why I think the numbers haven't improved, of a lot of work has been done. We're talking about how it's not, we're talking about on one end, solving diversity and inclusion is hard, or the other end, it's not that hard. We're talking about human behavior and pattern matching and hiring different people who come from different backgrounds. So I believe that the leadership, looking at leadership in the diversity and inclusion conversation, we're in denial, and people who are current in leadership position are doing everything they can in tech and even out of tech to control their power and wealth opportunities and not really trying to help everyone or enable or contribute to a society where everyone had a chance to thrive in this tech economy.
Yeah. Bridget?
Well, when I started in the tech industry, it was a really lonely place for me. It was really, my first internship, I was the only woman on a floor of 200 engineers, and there wasn't anyone to compare notes with or to figure out what can be done. And I think what has really changed in the last few years is that people have started to find each other. Maybe it's because there are more underrepresented people in the tech industry, but you know, maybe it's because there's digital ways to share things in Google Docs and on Slack, but people are putting their notes together. And I think the tech industry more than ever now has a roadmap of things that we could do, of real suggestions that would work. And so while I agree that the tech industry is in denial and that more should be done, it excites me that I feel like there are just more real things to lean into to make it better.
So let me go back to you, Wayne. You said it's not enough. So what's actually holding us back? I'm curious what you guys think are the biggest blockages to having more diversity and inclusion and sort of a new leadership lens.
Yeah, I would say there's layers to it, and then in slang, there's levels to it, right? So there's levels to it and layers in terms of looking at a particular angle. If you look at it in terms of current large tech companies, 3,000 plus, increasing their workforce numbers, and that we're looking at in terms of the problem in terms of recruiting and hiring process. All it takes, and I've tweeted about this, if you follow me on Twitter, I go on rants every now and then, is that all it takes is one individual who is not bought in to create an inclusive culture. That could be the hiring manager, it could be an executive, it could be someone in HR or in any department of the organization who's not bought in and not held accountable, then that is prohibiting people who are qualified to get in the door. And then if you look in terms of the entrepreneurship and the VC lens, just the last 2 years, we started seeing women LPs, women partners at VC firms, so the well-known VC, just the last 2 years. Right, Ellen had to go through what she had to go through, all these people who've been pioneering the movement, and now it's like, yeah, we got one, right? And then we're still not seeing the numbers. I mean, the data came out, I think, last week, 2 weeks ago. Venture capital for women is still around this whole year, I think, less than 15%. Could be 18. But still, just 2018, that little money is going to women entrepreneurs. While we know they create more profitable companies, and then much less African-American Latinos, like 2, 1%. So those problems still prohibit, you know, the opportunities. In terms of what I see solutions-wise, we just need to have people who are successful, like the panelists, to help thrive and make them be successful. This audience who cares about the topic to be successful, then you go out and create change, because I can't rely on the existing infrastructure to do the right thing.
Yeah. I think building on that, I mean, Silicon Valley was built on this culture of experimentation that we try something and when it doesn't work, we screw up, but we keep going forward. And I think the industry is really struggling with how to have a culture of experimentation on something that is so fraught as diversity and inclusion. I think that, you know, you'll see a leader get up on stage and say something and you say the wrong word and you offend someone. And there's no excuse for that. We all have to understand the impact of what we're saying. But sometimes I think that can lead to that person not wanting to try again, to not taking that Silicon Valley spirit of going at it again. And I think that that really is holding us back in the industry, and that the diversity advocates who are out there, we need to remember to be encouraging when people make mistakes. We need to give them another chance. We need to offer to help them and to believe it can get better.
Josh and Tina, I'd love to hear what you guys are doing at your companies as a whole to encourage diversity and inclusion. And specifics and numbers? Tina?
Totally. I mean, on my leadership team, it's over 50% female, but I don't think that diversity is just about skin color or gender or any choice that a person wants to make about how to live their life. It's really about inclusion and normalizing inclusion, because once you have a diverse workforce, if you're privileged enough to have one and have built one, that's when the work starts. Because inclusion is about having people get comfortable participating in meetings, having people get comfortable not just doing their job, but being who they are, and the workplace normalizing that kind of inclusion. So at Brandless, like, one of the things that we do is every week we have a spotlight meeting, which is an all hands in both of our cities with a video camera. And I go out of my way to not present at that meeting. I want all the teams to present, and I want people who've never gotten up in front of other people to get up in front of other people, because we're there to catch them and support them. So yes, I'll do Q&A if people have questions for me, but they hear enough from me. I want them to hear from everyone on the team. The other thing that we do is that when people join Brandless, we say, look, of course we hire you for what you do because we're trying to fill a job and get something done, but way more importantly, we hire you for who you are. And so how can we develop who you are while we are helping support you in what you do? And so we do this thing called intention ceremonies, where we ask each person in the company when they come, probably within the first 30 or 60 days, to set an intention personally. But then we ask them what we can do to support them in realizing that intention. And then we actually have them go up in front of, it used to be the whole company, but now the company is too big, so we try and keep it to about 12 or 18 people. And they share that publicly, and then the whole company signs it, and we hang it up on the wall. And so that's not about what their managers are going to figure out if they're executing their things, but in terms of who they are as people, like, everyone needs to be seen, everyone needs to be engaged, and everyone needs to be engaged beyond their deliverables. And so orchestrating how people eat lunch together, orchestrating like these little things that become habits and become part of the culture are critical things. So it's not just about, oh, we're going to hire a diversity officer. I'm not saying that's bad. That's a good thing. Anything you can do to move the needle. But it actually comes down to, what are you doing every day? And if so, setting a lunch table every day where everybody gets lunch and sits together, that changes things. Having a spotlight where people are in front of the company every week talking, that changes things. Having purpose ceremonies where people are doing things together, and then actually going out and doing activities where people are just normalized for just being together outside of offsites and planning and deliverables, but truly about that cultural connection, that is just something we practice every day as part of what we do for who we are.
Yeah, a couple of things. I love the word purpose and how many times you mentioned that. I speak a lot about intentionality. And so I think on this topic, kind of a couple thoughts come to mind. One, to what we were just talking about on why is it an issue? I think one reason, I talk to a lot of entrepreneurs, is there's a myth that you have to almost choose, to your point, between profit or values, or building a company in a way you're proud of, or winning. And I think that's a false myth. So it's actually helpful to just break that down, because in a startup journey, you're all very busy. You're spending your time trying to do a million different things, and it can feel like one more thing is going to just tip you over the edge. So one thing that helps at Gusto is we try to work backwards from, this is going to be a long-term journey, we're going to do it for decades. And when you use that lens, it actually is great for business, right? It drives retention of your team. If you have the ability to speak to an authentic culture that actually welcomes people, it speaks to your product quality. If you want to actually serve a diverse customer base, which hopefully most companies do, then you better be representing those customers in your own population. So that's kind of one myth that I try to help people debunk. And then in terms of Gusto programs, we think of hiring as a search for alignment. So, companies, in my opinion, don't convince candidates to join them. Candidates don't convince a company to hire them. Both parties are searching for alignment. And so at our company, we think about values alignment, motivation alignment, skill set alignment. And I think even just having those first two there versus just pure skill set pulls you away from just the growth at any cost or just filling a role, and gets you into this conversation on, what are our values? What do we stand for? And values, again, are very different than I would say diversity, right? Values are just philosophies. If someone's not a good values fit with Gusto, we have values like no egos or service mindset or intellectual curiosity. Does not mean they're a bad person. Just means that they'll probably be more successful somewhere else. But being really intentional around, what do you stand for? What is your core philosophy? And then having that guide your hiring practice has definitely been helpful at Gusto. One really tactical program that I want to mention to share that also we have a lot to get better at too. We realized several years ago that we were not where we wanted to be on engineering female representation. And so one project initiative we did was just publicly sharing that we're going to now, for the next 6 months, hire 50-50 male-female in engineering. And the activities that enabled that, so that's just a statement. The activities to enable that were a whole set of very outbound sourcing-centric activities, going to various conferences, career fairs, schools, things that we could go do to bring people into our funnel. And then we have our normal interview process, obviously. And that was very effective. So I think even if you're intentional, you know, we're not perfect. We realized something was wrong. We made an improvement. Now we're in more the 25 to 30% in female representation in engineering. That's still not our long-term goal, but it's definitely a big progress from where we were before.
What is your long-term goal for the female engineers?
Population of the world is generally 50-50.
Okay, right? Awesome.
And you know, it's interesting. I was going to say that in terms of intentionality, sometimes like the most like specific details and like just breaking it down. So one of our seed investors is Cowboy, led by Aileen Lee, and I was at an LP meeting giving a talk. And one of the other entrepreneurs at the talk was a woman who started a company called Textio. I don't know if you're familiar with them. Mm-hmm. But they basically do language diagnostics, and they've found that the biggest application of it today is to go and rewrite job applications and job postings and show you things that are more attractive to other audiences. So like if you say something like, you know, come join our engineering team, we crush it every day, like that is a signal unconsciously to attracting people who don't want to be in an engineering team that crushes it every day. Like, I don't want to be crushed. Don't crush me. Like, you just feel like you're going to get run over. So they're like, wait, if you want to attract different kinds of people, then don't put crushing it every day in your description of what the team is like. So like that, it's very tactical, but we actually just licensed the software program. And we're looking at all of our job postings to make sure that they are truly representing the culture we want to represent. I mean, we didn't have crushing it every day, but I thought that was like a great example of something that you don't realize is an unconscious bias that might actually not make people attracted to your company because it sounds like a different kind of thing. So it's the breaking it down like to its most specific parts and then solving for that and then building up from that as well.
And that idea of breaking it down, it really resonates. We basically said, you know, diversity inclusion, it's so hard. How are we going to get started? And then we thought, oh, well, you know, we're engineers. We have a backlog of bugs. Why don't we have a diversity and inclusion backlog? And we literally started using the exact same tools we use for finding defects in our software to find defects on D&I. And so we have a backlog, we've added items to it, we track progress on those. And what that's done is it's democratized the process where if anyone has an idea, they can throw it on the backlog. And if anyone wants to work on something, they can sign up for it to work in a group. And that has really just exploded our efforts on diversity and inclusion.
And Bridget, can you share how diversity and inclusion in your engineering team has evolved over the years?
Yeah, so when I joined Redfin, I was the only woman on our Seattle engineering team. So going back to that theme of times in my life when I've been lonely. But today 35% of our tech team are women. This is 7 years later. And so we've been following some of that journey that it sounds like you've been following to really intentionally try to grow our team, to make it inclusive, and to keep people around. So I do think that it's possible for these numbers to change, and we need more examples like Redfin where we're seeing the numbers move in the right direction.
How important is it to build all of this intentionally into your company when you start it, as opposed to growing the company to a certain size and then, you know, thinking about it?
Day one.
Yeah.
Day one.
It's definitely easier on day one.
Yes.
One way I guess I recommend if a founder, you know, again, back to when you think about companies, you know, when I think about companies where things are not the way they should be or people are not happy with the way it is, I'll make the assumption for the most part, hopefully, entrepreneurs have to be optimists, that no one's really striving to create that culture, right? No one's like, I'm going to create a culture that treats people this way. I'm going to savor that and celebrate it. Hopefully that's not the case. And if so, then that's not someone I ever want to interact with. But it's usually through a whole set of short-term optimizations, trade-offs, I have to do this, I can't get to that. It leads to a lot of times companies not spending time on this topic. And so I think day one, for sure. And one way, at least it worked at us to manifest it was we were three people working together. We felt really unique and connected in the way we worked, and we wanted to maintain that. So then we thought about what makes that unique, and that's what drove us to create our values, right? So you don't see values on our walls. You don't see values on t-shirts at Gusto. To me, you either live your values or you don't, and there's something that's you know, innate to a person. So our interview processes were screens for that. So hiring our first employee was an exercise in what do we stand for? And that can start again from your very beginning.
So some of the largest Silicon Valleys, which are famed for their workplace cultures, have kind of seemed to not been really able to move the needle on some of these issues that we're talking about, particularly diversity. And they've are facing other leadership questions besides. What does that say to you about what kind of model that sets for tech companies and the rest of the Valley that they're encountering some of these issues right now?
For me, the Valley is an ecosystem, right? And so everyone has a role to play, including boards and investors. And so I think that investors, even though most of the companies in the Valley are not public, but most of them do have boards, and they all have, to some degree, an investor, even if it's a seed or an incubator. And so I think that these things need to get built in day one, and that the board plays a role in this. I have the privilege of being a board member of a couple of other companies outside of my own. It's really important that the board asks these questions. It's really important that the board asks for culture surveys and wants to take a pulse on it and holds the CEOs accountable for reporting on those things. If you're going to have put out a term sheet and you're an investor and you haven't invested yet, ask those questions. Don't just pursue the deal because it's the hottest thing out there. Like, ask those questions early. I think if the whole ecosystem actually holds to that standard, things will change much faster.
But what's in it for the investor? I mean, a lot of this stuff is expensive and slow, and sometimes it's not easy to find the people, the diverse people to join companies. So what's in it for the investor? Wayne, yeah. I'm looking at you.
And then Bridget. I want to go back to your previous question about the Silicon Valley and the model, because of I don't know if we really realize that in the past 3 years, from I've been traveling across the world, going to different tech hubs, different cities, Seattle, Detroit, Austin, Melbourne, Australia. All these cities used to look up to Silicon Valley. All these tech hubs used to like, we want to be the Silicon Valley dis. And the narrative has been changed from that. We don't want to make the same mistakes that Silicon Valley, San Francisco has done around hiring, around gentrification, and then around everything, and even now sexual harassment. And so a lot has changed in terms of the model. If you plugged into the ecosystem and you go beyond just the traditional tech bro stereotype. And it's not just the entrepreneurs anymore either. It is the city leaders, it's the mayors, it's the governor, it's the business leaders who like say, whoa, 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 right? It's looking at some of the pushback Amazon is getting as well, because they don't want it to make the same mistakes we did. And so I say from the and with the diversity inclusion conversation either, we don't want to make those mistakes. So I look at from a model is that look at all the big tech companies, the Google, Facebook, Twitter, and Microsoft, so forth. Then you go from, you know, the Reddits and go down from there is the model has changed. And other cities, other tech hubs are looking to say, how can we do it differently?
And I think a lot of these big tech companies, they're still having this conversation internally about how to fix the mistakes that have been made in the past. When you can talk to leaders at these companies and they're asking questions like, people ask me, well, what's it like when Redfin hires software engineers from non-traditional backgrounds? And I'll say, I'm so glad you asked. They're doing amazing work. And I used to think that you had to have a four-year degree from Stanford to be a software engineer. I was completely wrong. And we have had so much success partnering with some bootcamp programs that provide just the right amount of training, and then we can complete that once they join our staff. But there are many people out there who are leaders at large companies, at small companies, who don't yet believe that, who haven't gone through that shift. And so I still think that there's an opportunity for people to really re-examine their biases in Silicon Valley and start to really change their perspective, not just expect that these diversity programs are going to fix everything for them.
Yeah.
On your comment, you said, what is the benefit to an investor? Yeah. I can think of two. So one, they should have better returns, right? So if you think about, at least from my perspective, and I know other entrepreneurs, when I meet an investor, I also want to know, what are their values? What are their philosophies? How do they approach hiring? How have they built their team? And if I feel like we're not aligned on that philosophy, I'm going to have less of a chance to choose them as an investor. And as a result, they'll not have a chance to invest in Gusto. So ultimately, it should just come back to returns. And then secondarily, if that's not enough, that should be enough on its own. I think the whole community, especially investors, should realize that, again, Silicon Valley is not a cottage industry. It's literally one of the biggest industries in the world. If we don't get more active on these topics, then whether it's government or other organizations will get much more active on our behalf. And so I think it's much better to be a part of that conversation. It's much better to be proactive and prevent it first. But if you're now a part of it, be a part of it versus ignore it.
And has the conversation amongst investors changed? Was that something that they brought up with any of you guys early on, or is it more of a recent thing?
I would say it's more of a recent thing. It's more recent because of everything that has happened. And I'm going to say recent. In tech industry, 2 years is like a lifetime, yeah. Right? 4 years is like a decade. So I'll say in the tech industry, the last 2 years, because of focus, I mean, we look at, like, everybody was in denial until 2014, Google listed diversity numbers, right? And then everybody was in denial even when Ellen went to trial. And so it's still a work in progress. To the question, like, what's in it for investors? Like one of the things I love about being at Backstage is that as we were saying, is that investors care about returns. All the data has shown that teams with more women and or more diverse teams are more profitable, provide higher returns. So if I'm an investor, I care about returns. I'm going to question why my portfolio doesn't look like the population of the world. So that is like, should be a light bulb moment. And then there's the accountability in terms of like, look at the state of the world we're in right now. So, you know, if I'm really looking at the world, I care about returns, if I'm an investor, and if I have great morals, I care about doing the right thing, if I'm an LP, I'm gonna start asking different questions. If I'm an investor, I want to start looking at not just the trends, like, okay, give me the cookie cutter pattern matching that has been put out for years. It's like, okay, an engineer, a sales guy, two engineers, go. Or Ivy League dropout, go. If I'm doing that and I'm going into 2019, you are doing it 100% wrong.
Yeah, and I think we've seen that research that shows that a more diverse team makes more money, and I certainly feel like that ought to be the case. But recently at Redfin, we've been trying to go down another level and say, well, why is that? Do we have case studies where we really think that a diverse team made more money? And we recently published one of the examples that we have. We'd been working for many years on this process to schedule a tour. When you're looking for a home, you need to go and see it, and we're trying to automate all of that. We'd had a team that took this approach of just writing a bunch of software. I mean, you're clicking button, and they wrote all the software, and we could not get our agents to adopt that software. We couldn't get people to use it, and they just kept trying to write more software. And so we shook up the team, and we put a gender diverse team on to this project. And almost instantly, what the team did is they said, "Let's stop writing software. Instead, let's start listening." And they organized trips to go to all of our markets across the country and to talk to real estate agents to watch how the software was using. And they started to see that what they had thought software engineers, that they hadn't gotten it right. And it was that difference, that experience of being an other that forces you to listen, that I think is what makes these teams, or it's one component that makes these teams more profitable. So that project, when we got it going, when that team fixed it, it led to $30 million in revenue over 18 months. So there was a real dollar value, and we think that it was because we took a different approach with that team.
And Tina, what have you found?
I found that, what's interesting is that if you take a purpose of your company and you put it out there and you say, look, I mean, at Brandless, we say we want to do better everything for everyone. And so that means everyone. And so sometimes that means the people in our company. Sometimes it means the people who are packing our boxes because they should be able to afford the stuff that we make. And sometimes it means the people that are receiving our boxes. And sometimes it means the people who don't even have $3 because today everything that we sell that's organic and non-GMO, et cetera, it's all $3. And so we say, what if you don't have $3? How are we going to better everything for everyone? And so we partnered with Feeding America because we said, look, they're the largest hunger relief organization. And so we're not an NGO, but we know that we want to fuel that. And so every time you check out at Brandless, we buy a meal in your honor. And so that means that since we started about 15 and a half months ago, we've given away over 3 million meals. But to better everything for everyone means that you have to walk that walk. The other thing is that at Brandless, for me, It's about the gratitude of being able to serve my employees. Like when we do our org charts, like I'm at the bottom. I'm not at the top of that org chart. Like I am there to serve. I'm there to serve my people. I'm there to serve the community. And I'm there to serve the people who aren't, that nobody is there to serve. And so I say every day at Brandless, we write a thank you note to a customer. And I literally had this talk at the Spotlight last week where at the end we were talking about how we were rolling out thank you notes because we have to get certain information to be able to know who we're writing to. But we don't want to disclose any personal information about a customer. So we have a process for doing that. We just re-rolled it out. And so I got up at the end of the Spotlight and I said, look, I need you all to listen to me like very closely right now. At Brandless, we make time to write a thank you note to every day. And if you want, sometimes I write 5 on Fridays. So it doesn't have to be every day, but you're writing, in theory, a thank you note every day. And this is how they're handed out. You just heard that. If you don't have time, or it's not that important to you to write a thank you note to our customer, I have a very extraordinary network. I want you to come see me privately, and I want to find you another job, because this is not the right company for you. Because this is who we are and we walk our walk. And if you don't have time to do that, then you're in the wrong place. But I'll help you find another place, but this is not the right place for you. And so it's finding sometimes the smallest things to say, like, this is how we walk our walk. You with me? You're not with me? How can I help you find a place that's a better fit? And so it's kind of making everyone a culture holder every day and building those muscles so that you normalize kindness, you normalize inclusion, you normalize diversity, and you normalize the goodness that is part of a company's intentions and their profit. And we work really hard, but we do it not just for ourselves. We do it because we're trying to democratize access to something that is much bigger. And I say, look, we're entrepreneurs, but we are social entrepreneurs. And we are here to fix a very broken system. And I'm not going to Washington to do it because I don't have time for that. I want to get stuff done. And we're going to democratize goodness. Are you with me? If you're not with me, how can I help you find another spot?
You're listening to a podcast of Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org.
So let's flip this leadership question and talk a little bit about employees. Recently, we saw a 20,000-person walkout at Google to force change. So how much change are you seeing employees demanding about diversity, inclusion, all sorts of stuff? Josh?
Yeah, I mean, I guess just a plus one to connect almost what you just shared in the question. You know, Gusto is the employees, I guess. I'm trying to parse even like what we're doing and obviously the people that I get input in. I'll give some examples, but you know, I also serve the team. And so everything and anything we do ties to, we call ourselves Gusties. It rolls off the tongue, but what Gusties inside the company are ultimately choosing to prioritize and spend time on. So I would say, you know, here's an example of something where I think we've made some progress and have a lot more to get better at. We kicked off a new college grad recruiting program in the last year. And one goal we had in that program was to have really broad representation from different backgrounds, in particular ethnic backgrounds. And so that led, similar to my earlier example, to a whole bunch of sourcing activities. So I was in Atlanta for 4 days at a job fair. We had members of our executive team go all over the country, different job fairs, and just spend time. There's no shortcut. Just spend time, meet students, be at a job fair. It's a wonderful experience, kind of brought me back to the early days. And it's very effective, and so that was a plus in terms of us now at least bringing in folks with more diverse perspectives. This was primarily in our Denver office. Now the learning, and this is a topic that's been a big discussion point in the company, especially in the last few weeks, is how do we set up those new college grads for success? Well, we did some things well, some things we could do better. I mean, you have a bunch of folks moving to a whole new city, moving to a whole new climate, working at their first job ever, and it's a startup. And so, you know, that's a topic, just to give you an example where I've been spending time, is how do we, for next year's program and even for this year's program, really make sure employee onboarding is done in a much more differentiated and unique way. I need to be higher touch, not just in the recruiting, but in the onboarding process as well. And I do a workshop every 2 weeks called Vision and Values with all the new hires joining Gusto. But the truth is, in this program, you know, that still just means I'm meeting folks one time. So definitely in next year's program, I'll be spending a lot more time with the new college grads.
Yeah.
Tina.
So I just think that It's really about, you know, I do an employee breakfast with the new employees probably every 3 weeks. And I always make sure that we do it in Minneapolis and San Francisco. Even if I'm in San Francisco, we sort of make everyone sit at the table so they, it feels like around a table. And some of the early questions that I got were, how are you going to scale this culture? Like, we came because we thought Brandless was so cool and all this, but like, how are you going to do that? And I said, look, I'm not. That's your job. Like, you came to Brandless. You are not only here to do your job, you are a culture holder. If you want this company to be the company that is going to make not only your career growth, your personal growth, and change the world in the humble way we hope to do it, then like, that's up to you. You tell me how I can help you. So I think this whole idea of like top down, it all has to come from the leader, as opposed to crowdsourcing from within your company and from within your customer base and from within the community that you build to serve, like that. And so I started answering the question that way. And now I don't get that question anymore, because I tell people, look, it's up to you. Just tell me, one, how do I not get in your way, or how do I support you to go for it, whatever that means. If it's, you know, silly t-shirt day or pancake day, or you want to go and do a community service outing, go do that. And like, how do we create an enable a place where you feel like you can come into work late that day because you're a glide, or you can start something and that we'll fund that, you know, kickball party or whatever it is you want to do, go for it. But I think the culture has to be held by the crowd, which starts with the team. And then that amplifies, and then they attract people, and they attract more people and more people. And so that's kind of just one way to just practice it every day.
Yeah, we have a saying that culture is something we create, not consume. And it sets this expectation, like you said, that everyone has to participate in that building. And it is something you have to do every day.
Yeah, I would say that if you're looking for a job, you try to work at one of these three organizations. Oh. You care about it. You hear, so that means you care about it, or you're interested. Try to get one of these three organizations. Yeah. That's what I'm going to say about that. I'd say that the Google walkout was interesting. It was very powerful. It was one of the few times I've seen the tech industry employees start to realize the power they have, which I also observe is the extension. What I would like to say is the movement that started to happen about 2 years ago when, for example, when the Muslim ban happened with the travel, then employees started speaking up. And then other things started happening in the industry, and the employees started speaking up. And then with this, it was so damaging and so ridiculous what happened at Google in terms of the years. The employees, I felt, was so fed up, they had to take change. They had to go to the streets, so to speak, because they've been building up to this moment where the frustration just hit this wall. Unfortunately, I think it's not happening enough. For example, if you've not been following the Uber story, a group of black Uber employees had to create an anonymous email address and send email clues to news organizations saying that this is what has been happening internally, with some racist remarks from their head of HR to our other black employees. And we want to report this and call it out, because this should not be kind of held in the back burner. And that's like phase one compared to what happened to Google, right? And what we've seen over the years is that it's usually been one employee who cares about diversity and inclusion. So, well, let's try to get unconscious bias training because I may be able to get that approved in my company. Well, that works or not, different story, but let's try to get that because that may get approved. Let's try to do something test yo because that may get approved. And it's sad that a lot of employees, where at one point, like, you were the only woman, that there's a lot of employees at these organizations feel like they're the only one. They don't have no power, right? They have no authority. They don't have the opportunity to team up with people who care to create change because of the narrative or the bad culture that's existing in the organization. So
I think when you can't compare notes, you don't know if you trust yourself that something's happening or it's just some kind of fluke.
Yeah, yeah. And people think it's them.
Yep.
And after a while, you know, imposter syndrome stirs up, and then the lack of productivity increases, and people are like, it's me. And it's not. It's the culture around you. Mm-hmm. And you don't have power. You don't feel confident, and then you can't thrive. So hopefully the tech industry employees, I'm not single star revolution, but I'm saying is that use your ERG groups if you have them, use your allies if you have them, and start demanding change in your organization, especially when you see things are wrong. I'm not talking about increasing diversity numbers. I'm talking about when you see something where someone is being sexist, being racist, is prohibiting someone to have the same fair opportunity as any other human. When you see things like that, injustice happen, call out that.
How do you guys encourage what Wayne was saying, that folks can speak out?
Yeah, I think we're seeing that, you know, as people are reading about all these things that are happening at other tech companies, they're really asking, you know, is this something that's happening at my company? And the people that we have at Redfin want to make sure that it's not. And so that has led to a push for more transparency about kind of every process that we have, everything about HR, everything, you know, how do decisions get made, and how does all of this work? And I think there's been more attention paid to that recently. So we just rolled out a salary transparency project, which is something that many other companies have done, but we did that because people were saying, well, how do you decide what to pay me, and what could I expect to make if I got promoted to the next level? And so it was something that we invested in, and I think that the request for that had to do with reading about things that are happening at other companies that aren't fair, wanting to make sure that that won't happen where you are in that environment that you're in.
Tina, Josh?
Oh, yeah. I was going to jump to just something really, I guess, tactical at high level, low level. So plus one on just, if you see it, speak up. And any company, any organization, you want to create as many avenues to support that. But also, if something does happen, then you have to take action, right? And that does mean trade-offs at times. And so, you know, words are powerful, and then take action. If someone is violating a policy, make sure it's very clear, it's unacceptable, and then that person should not be in the company. The higher level point is more, you know, we're mostly in a tech community audience. Data is powerful, right? So we do, similar to what you mentioned, just an analysis to see if you look at promotion paths or compensation changes, is there anything that's an anomaly against our data set of our representation in our employee base? And there shouldn't be any anomalies. And if there are, then that's something we go spend time looking into. And so I'm happy that there isn't. We just went through that process recently. But you want to share that with the company and be open about it and highlight, you know, if there is, then, you know, the actions you're taking to deal with it.
Yeah, so from our perspective, I think we're probably the youngest company on the stage, so it's new, but hopefully we're putting the right things in place, and we have, you know, resourced our HR and culture team so that we have, you know, four people on that team, actually five, and so they're not just there for recruiting, they're there for engagement, and they're there to be seen and heard and to make sure that people have access to them, and that we walk that walk every day. And so it's important to resource those things because they just don't happen. Like, everyone has the same 24 hours in a day. And so I think you have to invest in whether it's headcount or the discipline around those things so that people have the opportunity to scale.
So one of the things we hear over and over in Silicon Valley is the pipeline issue. You know, how do you find the people? They don't exist. How do you make a more diverse team if you can't find those people? They're not out there. Is that a myth, or, you know, how do you get around that myth?
I think you have to really broaden your idea of who can be successful in this industry. And it has nothing to do with lowering the bar. In fact, I think we're raising the bar when we bring more people from more backgrounds in. But, you know, I mentioned this before. I did have that bias that you had to have that four-year degree. I have one of those four-year degrees, those coveted degrees from a CS program. And I thought you had to have that, or you couldn't write code the way that people like with my training have. And it was just dead wrong. And I started to realize, like, there are people who are in roles that are adjacent to software developers, and you watch them and they pick up some SQL, they're a digital marketer, and they learn, they're like, wait, how does this work? And they start learning, and you realize, wait, they can code just like all of these other people. They just need, they need access to some training, they need some coaching, they need people to believe in them just like everyone else does, and you can bring them into the industry. So I do dispute that there's a pipeline problem. I think that we have a problem in who we imagine can be successful in the tech industry.
Yeah, just get out of the comfort zone. I think Silicon Valley, born and raised here, you know, my parents are teachers. My dad was a public school, high school teacher in San Francisco. Love the area. But it's an echo chamber, right? I mean, you have to get out of some of these geographic echo chambers. So, and it doesn't have to cost a ton of money. I mean, both on recruiting and customer, I mean, last year I wanted to go meet more customers across the country. We have customers in every zip code, every town, every city. And so, you know, me and a few colleagues rented an RV and just drove for 2 weeks, 4,000 miles, and met customers. It didn't cost too much. It cost like a fraction of a billboard, you know, right? I mean, it's, and we don't buy billboards. I just know the price. and that's why we don't buy them. But, you know, and it was a wonderful 2 weeks. We met lots of customers. That was about getting out of the echo chamber on customer interactions. But same thing with recruiting I mentioned earlier. Even if you're a 10-person startup, you can post jobs in other regions. You can have remote team mates. Or you can just go fly somewhere for a week and do a bunch of recruiting. Get out of the echo chamber.
Yeah, and I would say back to the ecosystem, we talked about boot camps. So some of our engineering leads literally went to female boot camps and started giving talks. And so I think it's really important. I mean, one of the reasons I'm here tonight, besides the privilege to talk about a subject that means so much to me, is because I want to put it out there. I want people to know that I'm the kind of leader. I want to attract people to what we're doing because it's part of what makes us unique. I don't want to be unique in that regard, but if we normalize it, then it won't be so unique anymore, and that would be awesome. So I think that, you know, it's incumbent upon leaders to be out there all over, whether it's with your customers, whether it's here tonight, whether it's talking at boot camps. Yes, 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 and yes, all of it. And you just have to be relentless in your pursuit of sharing and evangelizing your story and building networks of inclusion and helping each other. The thing I love about what AllRaise is doing is that, you know, venture capitalists tend to really compete with each other because they all want to land that deal. So I don't think you ever saw 400 male venture capitalists all getting together to share tips. That's just not how it works. But like, what I love about what they're doing is that they're actually collaborating as a community, even though they're also competing, but the collaboration. And so some of the ideas tonight are ideas that I'll bring back, and hopefully some of the things that I've shared might be things you'll bring back. And I'm writing about it. I'm talking about it. Our team is evangelizing about it, and we just are relentless in our pursuit of that. You can never rest.
Wayne.
Yeah, most definitely the pipeline problem is just a lie. It's not even myth. This is a lie, and created out by people who don't really, you know, it hadn't expanded their thinking, and I think want to hold a certain level of pedigree and credentials and power. So that's how I think the pipeline myth started happening. But I would say that what troubles me about the pipeline conversation, and correct me if I'm wrong, but most of the time it's connected to engineering dev roles, and that's another situation where. There's an article, I wish I had the dumb data off the top of my head, but I don't. But the article, it was on TechCrunch, no plug, but just it was on TechCrunch, talking about how the tech industry couldn't prove that people who had four-year computer science degrees actually outperformed or people who didn't. And it was like, here's the data. So you're trying to hire for people who actually, there's no data to prove that they are better. And if you look at people who are in engineering roles, there was data saying that most of them did not have a degree. So it was like, okay, we're doing it wrong. And talking about a pipeline. And connected to the pipeline, but a different argument is we focus so much on the engineering roles, and I get it. I like to code like every other good engineer. But the tech industry is made up of so many other important roles where we know there's not a pipeline problem, but we don't talk about that enough. Head of marketing, business development, sales, all these other roles, there's hundreds of people qualified. Why are those roles not as diverse as others? And then lastly, on this part is the pipeline. We get the argument at backstage is like in terms of pipeline of finding potential good underrepresented entrepreneurs to invest in. They're like, where are they? Are you going to be able to find them? It's like only the best are already in Silicon Valley or the Bay Area. There's no way you can find a potential, I don't want to say the U word, but a potential high growth company out, you know, in the middle of America somewhere. We're like, they do exist. And we're out to prove that as well. So pipeline's a myth on all three of those verticals.
So we're going to go to audience questions in a few minutes. So start thinking about your questions. When the time comes, raise your hand and we'll bring a microphone around. But one last question before we do that. I'm going to put you guys on the spot and ask, who is a tech leader you admire and why? Bridget.
Who is a tech leader? Oh, my goodness. So So one person that I really do admire is the CEO of our company. You know him. He's Glenn Kelman. I've been working with him for about 20 years, and maybe it's an obvious choice to pick my own CEO.
Good answer.
But I think what I admire about working with him, especially on inclusion, is how much he has changed and how much he's changed me, how much we've worked together to really examine what our biases are. And I think he's very humble and about what he used to think and what he thinks now, what we used to do wrong at Redfin and what we can do better at. And that has made this situation where I think we do have continuous improvement around D&I, that we're always striving to get better. And both of us believe that we can make the industry better, we can make our company better. So I really admire that approach, and I've tried to adopt it myself.
Wayne.
I'm do the same. I'm say founding CEO of Arlen Hamilton at Backstage Capital. She and I align so much in terms of values, mission, and purpose. And she is a proud gay Black woman, right? Who if you know her, she was on the cover of Fast Company last month. Just follow her story and what she was able to do on this short time frame of switching careers, sleeping on the couch, sleeping in the airport, raising funds, investing in Black women, investing to the underrepresented entrepreneurship ecosystem, done over 100 investments in underrepresented founders in the last 3 to 4 years is unprecedented. When people said it couldn't be done or they didn't exist, she went out and did it, and I admire and respect that.
So Tina, you can't choose your boss because you are the boss.
I'm not the boss. I work for them. So I would say, you know, a man who's really, really impressed me as recently as, you know, the last few weeks and for what I've watched from his career from a distance, because I know him, but I don't know him well, is Mark Benioff. What I really appreciate about Mark from a distance is he walks his walk. This is the community where Salesforce is born and raised, and this is the community that he is investing in addition to saying no and making and actually putting his values out there in the world and saying, we're going to walk that walk because I'm in charge and that's not okay. And so whether it's the children's hospital that he's invested in, the recent legislation here to tackle homelessness in San Francisco, as well as, you know, the one-for-one-for-one structure of how to think about investing back in purpose and profit is something that I just see him walking his walk every day at scale. And he's not afraid to take those risks as a public leader. And I really admire that.
And Josh?
So I'll add one more. I was going to say Mark, and I'll give a comment there and add one more. But it was plus one to the being opinionated. I think that's something that in tech and as leaders, it's easy to say that all we should focus on is our products. And I think, no, any leader, when you have a leverage point, a voice, a broader platform, you have a responsibility to at least have an opinion. Doesn't mean anyone has the right opinion on a lot of topics, but it's good to have an opinion. And I definitely see the courage. And I don't know him at all personally, but just something I've witnessed. Another leader I was going to mention who I also have had exposure to from afar is Jeff Weiner, who's the CEO of LinkedIn. And yeah, I actually was on an airplane yesterday, and he was doing an interview with Oprah. I don't know how that ends up happening. But he was interviewing her, and it was just about mission, values, and I saw at least a similar quality there on you can have big, ambitious goals, wanting to be proud of how you get there. Focusing on the people side at least seemed very authentic. One thing I wanted to add, though, on role models, if this is at all helpful advice, is it's always great to hear these stories. Everyone you meet, though, has flaws. And I think it's really important to know, even if anything we're sharing is of use to you, we have flaws too, right? So I try to meet anyone, get to know them, you know, whether it's a leader from afar, near, a teammate, and like learn something, but then take that as input and then figure out what I think is best. It's always dangerous, even with some of these amazing folks we're sharing, to ever think that anyone is someone to just follow or do what they say. You know, find out what you think makes sense.
Thank you. We're going to go to audience Q&A now. If you can keep your questions short and ending with question marks so that we can get to as many people as possible, we'd really appreciate it. First question, and I'm not sure I can see.
Hi, Josh, my question is for you.
Yeah.
So as a woman that works in tech, I totally respect and appreciate the fact that you're trying to bring more women into your organization. But as a woman in tech, I want to get a job not because I'm a woman, but because I'm the most qualified for the job. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I wrote notes. yeah, I just don't want to be a number to increase a percentage. So like Bridget was saying, she talks about opening your pool of what qualified means. So I'm wondering what you can do to attract a bigger pool of candidates that's not just based on gender, especially because we're moving into a direction where male and female is not the only gender identity that we're looking at.
Yeah, so just plus one to the question, the topic, I think all of the activities we're discussing is about how do you drive more exposure and, you know, again, pipeline is, I think, the inappropriate word, just top of funnel, I guess. Like, we want to have more ways for folks to engage and interact with Gusto if that's a company they hope to work with. So, I mean, some examples. Mentorship programs came up, boot camp programs. We did a program at Gusto to help people move into product management. It was from folks in our customer care, customer experience teams, gave them a chance to get exposure to this skill set. When they finished, we didn't actually have a lot of entry-level PM roles, so a number of those folks ended up getting PM roles at other companies. You know, I celebrated that because it meant we had someone going into a PM job that otherwise wouldn't have had the opportunity. So I just totally agree with the concept of your question. I mean, I think the value of sharing anything related to numbers or ratios is if there isn't at least an acknowledgement of something being out of sync with the population, then it's unclear even where to focus in the first place. So rather than say there's a million things we want to do, we try to be pretty surgical, choose a couple goals, and then we have decades of work to do as we progress through those goals.
We have a question to your right.
First of all, I want to thank every panelist that's here tonight and our panel moderator. I really appreciate your opinion. My question is kind of around some of the unspoken diversity we look at in tech in both Silicon Valley and elsewhere, and that's socioeconomic tech. So how do we engage and enable people who maybe come from more diverse socioeconomic backgrounds? Like, I consider myself a huge person of privilege, particularly from a socioeconomic background. How do we help people in lower diversity or lower socioeconomic brackets become successful or feel like this is a space that they can thrive and contribute to?
Yeah, I'll jump on that. Thank you for your question. Really, really thank you for the question. And also, before I directly ask the question, I would like to say that at least I know, and I feel like this panelist, we all know that diversity is more than gender, than race, and as you mentioned, so forth. There's transgender, there's LGBTQIA as well. There's age is an issue. So it's like a class is an issue as well. So even though we didn't mention a particular solution or mention a particular dynamic of diversity, we care about it, and we also know it's beyond just gender and race and the color skin and so forth. So to direct answer your question, I have a strong belief of going to people where they are, right? Yeah, that's like what Josh did. He traveled across the country, get that experience. I'm not saying that's the end all, end all solution, but I think it is a tactic that works, right? Going to people, going to different cities, going to different communities, going to different neighborhoods with people who represent that community or who could be a potential role model. And not talking top down, but talking with, listening, as you said earlier, listening, communicate, and say, this is a door, this is an opportunity for you in terms of being in tech and so forth. Because I know so many people who, if they didn't see an individual look like you all in this room and people in this panel, they wouldn't think, the only opportunity, the only reference they think that would be tech would be what they see in magazines, which historically just been white male CEOs. So we have to go to communities. We have to go to where they are. We have to show role models, and we have to do a dual listening and teaching both ways.
Yeah, I was going to jump in. I think like part of it could be just tactically. If you're expanding as a company, that's wonderful. Open offices in other locations. You then have a chance to tap into folks in those specific communities. So, you know, we were 150 people when we opened our second office. We view it as a co-headquarters model. So two offices today, co-headquarters, San Francisco and Denver. Whole host of factors to choose Denver, but right in the middle of the city. And now that office is larger than our San Francisco office. And I think just physical proximity can make a big difference. And I realize that myself because, you know, I'm lucky to be in the tech industry because of my parents' choices. My mom's an immigrant from Bolivia. My dad's from a small steel town in Pennsylvania. They are both the first in their families to go to college. they ended up in California for other reasons. You know, my dad had long hair, purple pants, wanted to go explore the music scene and stuff. But, you know, I was born here, didn't know what tech was until I, you know, now to match a stereotype, did go to Stanford and learned more about this community. But I didn't know what it was till I was at Stanford. And I think we're now in a stage where, you know, you don't have to go to Stanford to know about tech. We have an office in Denver. We're hiring there. If you want to learn about tech, join our office in Denver. Not trying to make an overt plug, but any company that has these other offices, go join a company in whatever city they're in. And as a tech company, open offices in other cities. You get access to great talent.
I've got a question in your back left.
Hey, oh, thanks everybody. It's actually a lot more nerve-wracking than I thought. So, Bridget, you spoke early on about experimentation, and I want to open this up to everybody. What are some times that you ran a D&I initiative or an experiment internally, and it didn't go well? And, like, what did you learn from that? I think a lot of companies talk about successes, but there's a lot to learn from times that we mess up.
Yeah, so one that we've been working on recently is just how our interview process works. We specifically have been working on that consensus process, which is after you do a bunch of interviews, you need to get a group of people to somehow decide whether to hire this person or not. And that has been a long project. We've been working on it for about a year to make it better. And what we found when we started looking at the existing consensus process that we had is that people would kind of just start talking about, I don't know, whatever there was questions there were was asked, but they'd come in and just start talking about one aspect of someone. And then the other people in the consensus meeting would start kind of piling on after that. And so we realized that as we were building this new process, we had to have a way to fairly look at the whole candidate. And so what we do now is we have a written form that people can fill in advance, and it itemizes our values and all of the topics that you're supposed to ask about. And we went through a couple versions of it where, you know, at what point should the manager start reading that feedback? Should they read it before the meeting? And then when people come together, what are the rules for how we can discuss things that maybe weren't actually written down beforehand? So we've gone through a bunch of iterations, and now I think we have a really good formula for it, but we had to keep asking ourselves to make sure that this new process was going to do a better job at bringing more people into our company.
Yeah. Wayne?
I would like to say that, and I shouldn't laugh, I'm sorry. I'd like to say that a lot of companies, I believe they won't publicly acknowledge this because how much money they spend on it, is implementing unconscious bias training at the wrong time. There's so many companies, I'm talking about like 20, 30 companies contacted us, not at Backstage, but with Change Catalyst and the work we do at Tech Inclusion, say, hey, we did unconscious bias training, we paid all this money, and now what? And you have to laugh, right? Because it's like literally they pay a lot of money, they implement it, and then they still got the same problems. There's no strategies, no accountability, and they implement it at the wrong time. And there's a my co-founder and wife on Change Catalyst, Melinda Epler, she comes from the background of anthropology and taught me about behavior change. But there's a whole behavior change life cycle that needs to happen in terms of with individuals and a company's culture to create inclusion. And there's a small box that unconscious bias training fit in that timeline when the company is ready. And we as a tech industry, when you start talking about diversity and inclusion, we went unconscious bias. And everybody's like, Google's doing it, Facebook doing it, let's do it too. And that was so wrong. That was so wrong. So we lost years of change that could have happened. And I wish we would have focused more on empathy. And I'm even starting with that as it comes with a different narrative. But I believe that's where the mistake has happened in history.
Tina.
So, you know, like I said, we're pretty young. I just try and make a different mistake every day because it's like I don't mind making mistakes. I make so many. It's just not, let's just not do it again. So the list is long. But what I would say from companies where I've had more time, that sometimes in my like enthusiasm around what I consider a top talent is to say, oh my gosh, like you're doing such an extraordinary job. You don't really have the skills for this other job, but that other job really needs you. And so you put that person in another job and the thoughts that you're mentoring them, you're giving them opportunity, you're doing all of that, but you didn't pre-negotiate what I call the way back. And so you put them out there and it wasn't a good fit and they end up leaving the organization because they went from being a top talent to a derailed talent. And so I now really coach people in this whole concept of what I call the way back. Like if you've been successful, that doesn't mean that the next rotation or team or opportunity means you're also going to be successful there because it may not fit your skills. You may not have your interest, whatever. But like to pre-negotiate with that employee and with the manager that they're going to transition to the way back so that you don't lose this top talent because you thought you were giving them this next opportunity and it ended up being the way out the door. So I think, you know, some of the mistakes that I've made is to just take people who I think are extraordinary and then just drop them in, you know, in the middle of the night like a Navy SEAL and say, like, you got this. I trust you. I trust you. But like, you know, I haven't given them like a headlight or like a map and they have no idea what they're doing. And therefore they are, went from feeling really mastery and success to feeling like, wait a second, I just derailed. I'm out of here because they lose face and all the rest. So I think it's like it's about that transparency of saying, look, we're going to try something. And if it doesn't work out, let's talk about what your other options are here. And then what you learned being in the cold face of trying something new. So that's something that that way back idea is actually anticipating like what the next couple of moves are going to be and then how you continue to develop a team and develop their talents and diversity across the organization.
And Josh?
I love way back. I'm going to use that. Yeah. Thank you.
Yours. You can plus one me.
I plus one.
I love that plus one.
I do plus 100. Actually, my parents, I don't know if your family, but my parents love emojis on Insta Message, and my mom's really into the plus 100 emoji right now, so plus 100.
Oh, that's good. Cool. Yay. I love your mom.
So I do, too. we're going to talk about family later. So to the example, I alluded to it earlier. I'll give a little bit more, and then happy to, if you want to chat after, give you a bunch more context. But it's the new college grad program that we kicked off, and just really getting back into the mindset of how do we set up someone for their first job ever. It's such an amazing responsibility and privilege to say that for this person, this set of folks. We had 45 folks join last year through that program. We'll have more this year that they'll forever say their first job was working at Gusto. That's amazing. I feel honored to even say those words. We could do more in terms of setting them up for success in the transition because working in a tech company, any company where you have all these new customs, all these new traditions, and a lot of those folks, to a goal of the program, you know, didn't have internships at tech companies. This is their first time working in a professional job outside of, you know, maybe doing retail, which is a great job too, just not the same dynamic. So we're focusing on that a lot right now, and I hope and know the program will be better next year, and then we're going to want to get it better again the next year. And it's never done. You always want to just improve.
Final audience question.
Oh, wow. Pressure's on. Okay. So all of you guys have talked about your experiences with your own companies, which makes sense. And you've all said something along the lines of the employees are the culture, and if you see something, say something. But how do you carry that over to like the smaller companies nowadays? How do you incentivize them to have inclusion, right? Because if the employees are reaching out to the leadership of like a smaller company, say like less than 10 people, and they're not getting any buy-in, how do you get that to happen? Like as an industry-wide conversation?
I do think there's kind of two types of small companies maybe. There's ones where you feel like the leadership is open to change, to learning, and to making some progress on this. And then there may be others where they really aren't open to that kind of change. And I think for each employee, and depending on what you care about, you may have to decide which kind it is. I will say that at a small company, especially, I mean, Tina was mentioning this too, like when a company's really early, you can't invest in all things. And so I think as people are joining small companies, your expectation needs to be that some changes might take time and that there might need to be a need to prioritize what those changes are going to be. So kind of everyone has to, I think, try to make it work, but there is probably a kind of company where, you know, I don't have a good answer for it.
Yeah. Others?
I would say yes and. I won't do the plus one, but I do yes and.
Plus 100. Yeah. Oh, wow.
Plus 100. Plus 100,
okay. Love
all
that.
Right, it got me. Plus 100. Agreeing with what she was saying is that you look at the diversity and inclusion and what type of change you want to make. A lot of people say, oh, we want to just do something really big up here. I would suggest if it's a small company of 10, pick one or two things that you want to gradually create change on and start tracking that and start tracking how and when you are communicating that on that personal level with your either employees or managers, and then over time see does anything start changing with your goals that you want to connect with. It's almost like project managing your own D&I change that you want to happen on a small scale. Because you should be on a human one-on-one level to start having that dialogue, but also assess where the company and the people are at, see if they're ready to have that dialogue.
And just to add to that, there's an entrepreneur that I, who's a friend who I really admire. Her name is Amy Chang, and she started a company called A Company that was actually sold to Cisco. But what I love that she did was every time she had at the time, I think like 45 employees, and she said, every employee I find a mentor for. And so she literally went into her network. She grew up at Google. She was the project manager on Google Analytics and has like just an extraordinary reputation. And she said, I can't mentor like 45 people. We don't have time for that. I don't have like a huge team and HR teams that can do all of these types of programs. But what I am going to do is I'm going to find people, find out how each employee needs to grow or wants to grow and wants to develop. And I'm going to go out and find somebody that, and I'll make them an advisor to the company. So she created an advisory board that was very, very large. And she gave all the advisors like a very small piece of the company. So it wasn't like she was out there, you know, giving away massive amounts of stock. And she said, this is like my mentor pool. And then she would basically match employees with people in the advisory pool who were mentoring because she didn't have enough of a team to do that. And I think she did that like starting with like 10 people in the company. It was just really remarkable as she figured out a way to take what she learned in really big environments and apply that to her startup and gave everybody the opportunity to be developed in a way that like the actual size of the staff couldn't handle it. So that was a great story. And she, you know, sold her company to Cisco and now is running AI for Cisco, so she continues on.
Gusto's COO, Lexi Reese, who's an amazing leader, was one of those advisors.
Really?
So, small world.
Awesome.
My answer to your question is, if you're in a company that small, I'm taking it from the lens of being an employee, first and foremost, see if the person, the leader, is open to the conversation, and if you feel like there's an aligned set of values and philosophy on the importance of the topic. So you're shaking your head. If not, you know, then you shouldn't be there, right? Because basically there's not an opening to even have a dialogue. But if there is the alignment, then absolutely there's still not a, hey, do what I say. It's let's make sure there's priorities, projects, you know, trade-offs, what's the timeline against something. Make it a collaborative experience. Hopefully it never should feel antagonistic. But especially at that size, it should feel very much like a partnership. You know, you're 1/10 of the company in that context.
Thank you to our audience for your questions. Let's end now with a twist on Inforum's infamous, famous final question. What is your 60-second idea to make workplaces more inclusive and diverse? We'll start with Josh and then go down to Bridget.
Yeah. So I'm going to kind of continue with some of the stories I shared. Get out of your comfort zone, and I'll specifically say geographic comfort zone. I think why that's powerful is it can give you exposure to other people of different backgrounds, skill sets, culture, socioeconomic means. It's just a very easy, quick way to do that. And it can even be in a region, right? So I think in Silicon Valley, we talk so much in San Francisco about how tech is such a big part of the community here. I looked it up, and I think this is approximately accurate, but 27-28% of the workforce is in tech, which means it's not the majority, which means there's actually a ton of people working in San Francisco who know nothing and don't connect to the tech industry. So it doesn't always mean doing a road trip like I did, although by all means do that too. If you want to, just it means getting out of any geographic comfort zone, echo chamber, bubble that you might have. If you see anything around you that seems more like a majority of anything, that's not the way the world is, right? So go into the other end of that spectrum is my advice.
Tina?
I would say that for me, the idea of practicing your values with everyone in the company all the time, and that it's not a campaign, it's not a program, it's not a department, it's not an individual, that it really has to be owned throughout the organization, and find ways every day to find activities, whether it's lunch, I mean, you know, people eat lunch every day, whether it's other types of ways in which people can interact outside of their core skills. So whilst engineering might sit together, that doesn't mean they should eat together. So finding ways to constantly creating community with inside your company that is not about what they do, but about who people are, and enabling and supporting that across the organization actually builds normalcy, and it normalizes the idea that all kinds of groups can mix and find affinity outside of their acumen.
Wayne?
Since the second idea, one is I would say that on a company level, if you don't already have a committee around creating strategies to interact with different groups, different identities, different cultures throughout your organization, throughout the year, create a calendar. Don't do the identity. Don't do the months like Black History Month, Pride Week. Don't do those. Do those, but add more. Let me start off. Do those, but add more, right? And just because if you don't have these interactions, these relationships with different identities, different cultures, different humans, you lose out on I feel like, what we are designed to do as humans and thrive. And on an individual level, because I think so much it's a company, but as individual level, I would encourage you, try to become self-aware of how you think, feel, and treat other humans who are different than you on any level. And not just in the workforce, but as you leave this event, walk down the street, go to the grocery store, think how you're treating different humans who are different than you, and become self-aware. Was I biased? Was I not biased? Was I racist? Did I do this? Did I do that? And then you develop this practice as, am I being a good human to society? Am I treating everyone as I want to be treated?
So my advice for everyone in the room is just to hold on to your optimism that things can get better. I mean, we've talked about a lot of really difficult topics tonight. It's going to take all of us working on this over a long period of time. So we need to look for the little things that are getting better. We need to celebrate those wins, not just be outraged at the things we read about in the media, but there are things that are getting a little bit better. And celebrating those wins, maintaining our optimism, that's how we're going to make the tech industry better.
Thank you for that. Yes.
Plus 100.
Yes.
Well, let's give a big plus 100 or plus 1,000 to all of our panelists. Thank you, Josh Reeves. Thank you, Tina Sharkey. Thank you, Wayne Sutton. Thank you, Bridget Fry. Thank you to the New York Times. I'm Pui-Wing Tam. Thank you for joining us at InForum at the Commonwealth Club. Have a great evening, everyone.